This is the Politics Albury Wodonga podcast, and you're with our voice host, Ben Habib. Today we're talking local history with Bruce Penney, who's adjunct professor in the School of Environmental Sciences at Charles Sturt University's Thaguna campus. Bruce takes us back in time to three key periods of local history with national significance: the Gold Rush, Federation, and the post-World War II migrant influx. So please enjoy this discussion with the Border Region's eminent historian, Bruce Penney. Hey, Bruce Penney, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ben.
Okay, this region has been really the epicentre of a lot of interesting episodes of Australian history. And one I'd like to start off discussing is the Gold Rush period. So could you just give us a brief outline of how the Border Region figured in the Gold Rush?
Well, the gold rushes were important to the border in that they were primarily a Victorian phenomenon. And the big rushes initially south of the border was the ovens that brought a lot of people up into the border district. That brought so many people to the Albury-Wodonga district, and Albury people started to think of ways in which they could make money out of it. And one of the ways that they adopted was to provide the foodstuffs for the diggers, both at Beechworth and then in the ovens. And Albury grapes, for example, were prized by the miners. They needed nutrition from grapes as well as from meat and bread. And that gave a stimulus to local production. The second way in which I think it was important to the border district was the way in which attention shifted to the border, and New South Wales government decided it had to hurry up a connection with Goldrich, Victoria, and made improvements to the highway. And that included putting up bridges along the road. Mm-hmm. And one of the bridges that they planned for was the bridge that became known as the Union Bridge, because it joined the two colonies between Albury and Wodonga. And at that time, Henry Parkes within the Parliament declared that this was a significant development, because it was linking the two colonies. Victoria had just recently separated, and he hoped it would augur the well for a federal capital being established in the future when the colonies came together again, that would incorporate land that was in Victoria and land that was in New South Wales at Albury and Wodonga. So it was the beginning of a federal city ambition that was important to the border district. A third way in which it was important to the Albury district and Wodonga district was the influx of Chinese. Chinese travellers had to traverse that border too, and there are many accounts in the police courts of the troubles that they went through trying to get across the border when the colonies introduced poll taxes and different regulations related to the travel across the border. And some of those stories relate to ways in which they got around the difficulties by crossing at different spots rather than the official crossing spot.
Yeah, that's interesting. As a South Australian and someone who spent a lot of New Year's down at Robe, now that was a landing place for a lot of Chinese, and then they'd trek across the border.
Yeah. One of their ruses was to cross at Mungap Arena, and the officials discovered trees in which they'd put Chinese markings indicating to their fellow countrymen travellers who gather here at 12 o'clock and we'll nigger across, kind of messages that they didn't really approve of. But there were more Chinese came as a result, not only of the Beechworth diggings, but of the reef mining at Rutherglen district. And they were heavily involved in that. So much so that a small Chinese community grew up at Wagunya, and a small Chinese community grew up within Albury. The one in Albury was very intent on producing vegetables, and the one at Wagunya was out to do contract work, clearing land for farmers, etc.
And what's the interplay between these new Chinese migrants and the local population at this time?
Not always healthy. You know about the Buckland River riots, in which the Chinese were run off the Buckland River. The locals looked on them some askance. They were wary of their culture. At the same time, they enjoyed the notion of having a being a cosmopolitan community and being able to draw on the diversity of having the Chinese come along to appear at their processions, and march with their dragons and lit off their papers and join in the Europeans in celebrating, for example, the arrival of the governors in 1876. And I always liked the notion in which they appeared in 1897 at a function that was held for the record reign of Queen Victoria. And the local newspaper says the Chinese had arranged for Bendigo Chinese to come and help in the celebration. And as a result, they were given admission to the grandstand. And I like the way that for the first time, these people who grew vegetables that they'd sell around the community and lived down at the Chinese camps near the Union Bridge were admitted into the grandstand. This seemed to be a development. I found it interesting that in their prosecutions in the court for them trying to avoid the poll tax or trying to nick over the border this way or that, the local solicitor, who was of course paid to defend them, managed to tap on a fair amount of community support for the fact that the Chinese seemed to be hard done by. And you almost get a sympathy for the fact that some Chinese had travelled all the way from Broken Hill down to Melbourne so that they could get to Sydney, and they were stopped at the border because they were trying to enter New South Wales again. When they just left New South Wales, the only way to get to Sydney was to come via this route. Well, the Chinese wanting to visit the herbalist across the river was stopped. Well, the Chinese wanting to meet his parents across the river was stopped. And this was given in the newspaper a kind of sympathetic approach. And it was almost as if people were feeding the human difficulties of having a migrant group amongst them.
Yeah, and as the 19th century draws to a close, the role of the Chinese community in Australia had some bearing on the Federation debates. What went on here?
Oh, I think the usual line, and I don't know that I can develop it any further, is that Australians were united in trying to keep the Chinese out. And one way that they could be sure of that was to come out as a federated nation instead of the different colonies having their different approaches to trying to control Chinese immigration. I don't think that the anti-Chinese feeling or the concern about Chinese immigration loomed large in local debates about federation. People were much more concerned about the economics of federation. And in particular, they were much more concerned about the impact that federation had on their border and their access to markets. And a market that was rightfully theirs a few miles away that they were prevented crossing because there was a river and because there were custom barriers. That's their concern. That's their injustice. Chinese, they could live with.
Okay, well, perhaps let's explore the role of these customs barriers and the river, which played in federation, because that's an interesting story in itself.
Yes, and again, the regulations varied from time to time. I can't quickly recite the different ones, but Victoria would be anxious about trying to protect its border from influx of New South Wales goods, and other times New South Wales would be excited about protecting its border from the influx of Victorian goods. But the locals felt aggrieved because they saw this as they saw a lot of problems as being city-centric. And indeed, this is a feeling that goes on for some time, that they see the colonies as being related to Melbourne and Sydney rather than anywhere else, and the colonies were serving the interests of the metropolitan areas. So they were really out on a limb, that what was convenient to Sydney and what was convenient to Melbourne, that the governments were worried about, and that was overriding any other issues of anyone else that lived in the particular case, in the particular states. And that was a real problem for them. Now, I remember Stuart McIntyre talks about the Corowa Conference, and the Corowa Conference was one of those local initiatives to bring together the people of all colonies to talk about the need for federation. And he said he'd give two cheers for Corowa, that it had excited some interest, but not. It wasn't great. One of the prime things about the Corowa Conference was to get rid of the border barriers. And it's that I'd use as my central argument, that they were worried about their own particular backyard, their own particular difficulties in the marketplace.
And tell us a bit about the railways.
Well, railways and rivers were the two things that were excluded from the federal contact. And we know that now as we complain about water management policies in different areas. Mm. And they were excluded because they were too hard to solve. The states had made enormous investments in railways. The states were not going to give over their rivers to anybody. So the two unresolved areas of the federal constitution were both rivers and railways. And in a way, they came back to haunt the Australian people.
In the two hard baskets for 100 years.
That's right.
But at this time, why didn't the states want to relinquish some control over water management?
It was a precious commodity. New South Wales claimed the waters of the Murray because during up the border, a boundary had been set at the southern bank of the Murray. So all the water in New South Wales belonged to Murray. And I really liked the way in which the people of Echuca, when there was a flood, telegraphed the New South Wales government and said, come and get your bloody water out of Echuca if it's your water. But New South Wales held hard that it owned the water. And South Australia, at the other end, of course, it claimed that it had some rights to water too. And so there were three colonies involved on what should happen with water. And as you know, in the early years of Federation, they all met together. And they come to some compromises and what kinds of shares of that water they might have. But even in building the Hume Reservoir, the Hume Dam as it's now called, shortly after Federation, one of the first big public works after Federation, the Victorians pointed out that it was enclosing water that were Victorian waters from the Mitter upwards, that they still had the Kiwa, but they were giving over their waters of the upper river spaces into the Hume Dam that would then be divided according to a formula on what should go through to South Australia and what New South Wales and Victoria could access. It was just a matter of holding on to something that they thought was precious. And they couldn't see any rhyme or reason to give it over to another authority.
Okay, and we'll go back to the railways again. And tell us about the history of Albury-Wodonga as a meeting point for the two different gauges and the kind of effects that had.
Well, the Victorians will kick off the mark. I think there's been huge advantages for Victoria being a compact little state.
Mm.
And one of their first efforts for the railway was to join Echuca to the railway. And that was marvellous because it tapped the trade that was going up and down the Murray River. Mm. It trapped the sheep from Deniliquin down through the travelling stock reserves down into Echuca. And about 1864, they built that one. Then in 1873, having considered in the late 1860s, they decided to tap the train further up the Murray, and they decided to put a railway to a spot opposite Albury. At this stage, even the Victorian government wasn't sure of this place called Belvoir that was opposite the Albury, but they wanted to go opposite Albury. And they saw advantage in going opposite Albury of tapping Albury's wine trade. There was a big wine trade in Albury at that particular stage. And that railway of 1873 really pulled down a lot of New South Wales produce, particularly wool, to Echuca and then to Wodonga to go to Melbourne. And the New South Wales Parliament starts producing papers each year on the amount of wool bales that are being sent south to Melbourne. And you can see they start to get excited that they're losing this trade to Melbourne. So in the late 1870s, they start to venture to pull their railway that had got as far as Goulburn, a Yass, further south so that it could meet up with Wagga, and then eventually in 1881 with Albury. And they build this big triumphant railway station. It's the big border marker. They'd done so at Deniliquin. They built a whopping big courthouse to show that it was New South Wales territory and it owned it. And this is what governments do sometimes on borders. You claim the territory. It's a bit like a dog claiming territory by pissing on the trees. And here they were claiming the territory of the border with this huge railway station in Albury. It was the grandest railway station that they'd built in extending the railway so far south. Now, some of the politicians foresaw the need to join the two railways, and they were joined 2 years later. And indeed, that had been foreseen before, otherwise they wouldn't have adopted the Aubrey route. When that connection is made, it's of great advantage to both Melbourne and Sydney. They're in contact with each other quickly and easily. Produce, newspapers, livestock, ideas could flow north and south. There was a hiccup in the, a stutter, if you like, in the national conversation, and that was the two gauges didn't mesh. Victoria insisted that Wodonga was a change station. New South Wales insisted Albury was a change station. So they became two change stations, Wodonga to look after livestock and Albury to look after passengers and produce. And this was a whopping big stimulus to local development. The carters around Wodonga, the shopkeepers of Albury, all realised the advantages of existing at the break of gauge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an enormous job manufacturer of people working on the railways in distributing goods, because in effect both of them were still a terminus station, and yet they were a through station through to the other. And that's been very important.
And of course the location of some of the military bases, and Bandiana is strategically placed for this region
There was, after the First World War, they did a strategic study on where they should, how they should look at Australia's defences, and there was papers put forward about the importance of these railway junction places. And at Wollinga, they built a big wholesale munitions depot. Then, come the Second World War, in 1940, they realised that there could be invasion of Australia, and they didn't know whether it come from the north or the south. So they established Bangilla and then Bandiana. Bangilla to muster troops and then to train troops in a variety of activities, and Bandiana as a logistics centre, a great storage centre, so that the materials that were needed to conduct war could be rushed north or could be rushed south as required. So it was the break of gauge that meant that both Albury and Wodonga had a very good war. It was a profitable war for local business people. A lot of army people present, a lot of army functions being carried on. The Bangilla Hospital was able to cope with 11,000 personnel. Now, there wasn't 11,000 personnel in the district, but it showed you the idea of the hugeness of the military operation.
Mm. And of course, at the end of the war, Bangilla takes on another function, doesn't it? You want to explain the history of that?
Well, at the end of the war, they wondered what to do with 830 huts, miles of roads, water storage capacity, what to do with the buildings that are at Bangilla. Bandiana wasn't a problem because they still needed it as a storehouse. There were lots of materials sent back from the Middle East and the Pacific, and they put them into storage there and guarded the storage. Bangilla, there was a dearth of building materials, so there were very serious suggestions on what to do with Bangilla. Mitchell, the Wodonga, a local representative, hoped that they would do what they'd done at Mildura and make a base for a university, as the University of Melbourne had done at Mildura, but that wasn't to be. Instead, the federal member for Indi, McEwen, was able to get Bangilla established as McEwen had got Bangilla built in 1940. The federal minister for immigration, Arthur Corwell, decided to use the military establishment of Bangilla for the receipt of displaced persons from Europe. He'd been to Europe and he'd come home wanting to convince Australia that these displaced persons would make wonderful immigrants. Australia needed more people if it was to withstand any future attack. Australia needed these people because of post-war reconstruction. It needed a greater labour force. And these bolts, these beautiful bolts, as he described them, would help to do the job.
So it's the populate or perish argument.
Populate or perish. And I think Bangilla, to me, always represents our national vulnerability. It was built because we were vulnerable from attack during war. And at the end of the war, we're still vulnerable from attack. also vulnerable because we need to build ourselves up economically. So Bangoola is a kind of expression of Australia being uneasy about its future.
Mm. And so what does this big influx of foreigners into the region do to the border area's ethnic composition?
It obviously changes it. I think the statistics in 1947 show a handful of people living in Wodonga that had been born anywhere other than Australia or New Zealand, and perhaps two handfuls of people in Albury that had been born in places like Lebanon or Greece, but very few people had been born overseas. It was very Aussie community. Now suddenly Bangoola grew in its first years to be a bigger community than Wodonga itself. And those people didn't speak, a lot of those people didn't speak English, and they had very different backgrounds to the people who'd been born in Australia.
So what are the social consequences of having these new people in the region? How are they received?
The local community liked to think that it was generous and supportive and helpful and encouraging to the newcomers. Like to think that. The migrants seemed to indicate that they thought that they got, that most people were indifferent. It was all very well for Rotary to organise international nights and stand up and spruik the advantages of having these people from a variety of lands come. And then at the end of the night say, good night, see you next year. That the support wasn't there. The Border Mail at one stage talks about a play being put on about a family where the girl has married a new Australian, and it ends the review with, and this could happen to you. That these strangers were something that perhaps we didn't want mixing with our daughters or sons. That all very well if they were strangers and they moved on quickly out of Bangoola to jobs all around Australia, but we weren't too sure about them staying. Didn't take long, however, for them to realise that a lot of the immigrants were people just like themselves, and that they were starting at the bottom end of the ladder, that they were in, some of them in dire economic positions, that they'd built, for example, rough cottages at Kalara, Wodonga Flats, and yet they were making a go of it. And so they kind of entered that suburban myth of being just other forms of battlers. And there's admiring bits appear in the local press saying, look how these people have done the right kinds of things and helping our country along because they're helping themselves and their families along. So attitudes soften as the years go on, but a lot of immigrants still remember the words of Bolt, Refo, New Australian, Wog, Dago, and various kinds of discrimination.
When I speak to my grandmother, she came out from Ukraine with my grandfather at the end of the war, and although they didn't go to Bangoola, they went to the camp in Adelaide and ended up there. But that, what you've just said, is an experience that very much would resonate with her.
Well, you'd appreciate if you're Ukrainian that Wodonga people knew Kalara to be Little Russia, which of course incensed the Ukrainians that they were suddenly embraced in being Russians when they'd fought a long time not to become Russians.
Yes.
Let alone the Polish people who lived at Kalara, but they were all Russians. People have a tendency to generalise.
Yes, I can imagine how insulting they would have found that, being called Russians. Okay, Bruce, I think that is a really good foundation you've laid about some of the interesting history of this region. I want to thank you for appearing on the podcast.
That's fine.
Thanks a lot.